Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
This is Heidi Moore of The Guardian in for the vacationing Brian Lehrer. One thing I know Brian is not doing on his vacation right now is visiting a Renaissance fair. We've all heard of Renaissance fairs, even if we haven't experienced them. They set up camp outside some big cities, and you have an idea of what you'll see there. Performers walking around in heavy velvet dresses, billowy shirts, eating turkey legs, and singing while accompanied by medieval instruments. It's kind of a cross between a carnival and a historical Disneyland. But there's more behind the court gestures and the nostalgia, says Rachel Lee Rubin. She's the author of the new book, Well Met, Renaissance Fairs and the American Counterculture. And she argues that we owe the 60s as we know them to Renaissance fairs. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good to be here.
So, okay, first I have to ask, why did you choose to study Renaissance fairs? Did they capture your imagination?
Well, it's actually somewhat of a funny story. I was at the Renaissance Fair in Massachusetts with my then five-year-old, and along with us was a friend from England. And he was quite horrified at what he saw as the misrepresentation of English history at that fair. And I was somewhat tickled by his horror. But then I started to think it would be seriously interesting to see, you know, to sort of think in an organized way about what use people are putting to that history as represented. Because obviously, you know, their interests were not the same as his. So when I started to dig into it, first of all, I realized it went much further than I'd been thinking, and that, you know, as you said in the introduction, that it had a whole lot to do with the creation of what we now call the 60s.
And I'm going to ask you about that in a second. First, I want to find out from our listeners if they've been to Renaissance fairs and what they think about it. If you've been to a Renaissance fair and you feel like maybe you were part of the counterculture, call 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can leave us a question at WNYC.org. So, Rachel, you make the point in the book that the Renaissance fair actually helped the 60s counterculture grow, and you have some great pictures there from album covers of the Byrds and the Isley Brothers. Tell us how that happened. How did Renaissance fairs fuel the 60s?
Well, it's really completely fascinating. I think that a lot can be told about the early fair. The first one was in 1963 by looking at one house. And the house is in the Laurel Canyon neighborhood of Los Angeles, you know, long known for hosting bohemian types. It was the home of two people, Doris and Bob Carnes, who were completely crucial to creating the early fair. And Doris Carnes had time to do this because, among other things, she was a blacklist. She was part of the Hollywood blacklist, so she wasn't working. The house then was soon owned by Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. And the interest for me is that there's this point where those two generations of artists and activists overlapped in that neighborhood. And at the beginning, I heard you played, you know, Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, and you just mentioned the Byrds. The Byrds also moved to Laurel Canyon, part of that sort of high-flying rock and roll scene, immediately, you know, wrote a song that was basically a Valentine to the fair. So you have this older generation of Hollywood people and this new generation of rock and roll artists who were sort of teaching each other how to create the early fair.
Mm-hmm. And so why is the nostalgia for the Renaissance in particular? On the face of it, the Renaissance seems like a really unlikely fit with the 60s. There wasn't a big women's rights movement during the Renaissance, obviously, and they didn't even have good plumbing. So why would anyone want to go back there?
Well, people weren't as interested in plumbing, but that's a very good question, especially because, you know, the early fair, one of the things that I really found there strongly was an interest in sort of experimenting with new gender roles and new family arrangements and sexual nonconformity as well. The Renaissance fair sort of grew out of a children's theater program in which the Italian Commedia dell'arte was the most popular part for the kids. And then the woman who founded the fair, Phyllis Patterson, thought, well, what if we could do this as a real fair and sort of staged it more broadly with musicians and crafters and, you know, performers and food and all of the rest. The whole thing was presented. At first, it was a benefit. There was a radio connection. It was a benefit for the first public radio station, Pacifica Radio, its Los Angeles station.
Right.
And so, what you've said just really hits at it, sort of taking what they found useful from history and also adding in what was important to their own values.
Right. And now we see some interesting things there. Let's go to Tony from Brooklyn. He has some experience of a Renaissance fair. Tony, are you there?
Yes.
What did you see?
I was the best man at a wedding at a Renaissance festival in Texas, about 70 miles north of Houston. And the groom was, you know, a 60s person like myself. And he was remarrying at about 42, 45. And he picked the Renaissance Festival to have his wedding. And it was a great time.
What did you see there?
It was a good time. And I've been back many times in Texas to the Renaissance Festival there. And actually, we rented the costumes that the previous court owned. Did it all up. It was really good. It was a great experience.
That's by far the biggest fair in the country, the Texas one.
Oh, I have friends that's, you know, every October, that my neighbors in Texas on the lake, they participate every year. They bring their trailer there and spend the whole period of time that it's open living there and participating as players in the fair. Mm-hmm. And it's quite amazing. I really enjoy it. It's a really good time, especially that one. And that's my story.
So
that's a great one, though. It really is remarkable that there's this sort of dedicated group of people who will go, you know, like you said, every weekend it's open, camp there where that's allowed, you know, drive there where it's not. And even there's a special word for those people, which is patron, combining play and patron.
Right. And, you know, it was when I found out what toast meant, because I had to do a toast to, as best man. And I went and researched it at the Houston Library and found out that at the end, when they would toast in England, they would put a piece of toast in the wine glass and they would say, drink to the toast, which meant finish it until you got to the toast. Little piece of history.
It's adorable, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great piece of history. So, Rachel, what would you see at a Renaissance fair these days? How has it developed since the 1960s when it was this counterculture movement to today?
It's changed a lot, but there are definitely some very key holdovers. There are still plenty of people who work at the fair. This is their economy, and they travel the circuit. There are different Renaissance fairs operating at different times, including, you know, some people who don't have a permanent home outside of the trailers or the booths or the tents they sleep in at the fair. And I think that definitely developed out of this sort of 60s countercultural ideal of traveling. You know, we all know the meaning of the Volkswagen minibus or the hippie hitchhiker, you know. So the fair sort of, I think, the early fair encouraged this and sort of fit in with this ideal. And there are still plenty of people who do that too. They call themselves Rennies for shorthand, the fair workers. And one of them said to me, "You can't call yourself a Rennie unless you wake up at least 6 months out of the year looking at plywood," you know, referring to the booths that they that they sleep in after hours. So, you know, that sort of thing, the privileging of the handmade people who sell crafts at the fair and who really, really care whether something is handmade instead of, mass-produced, that's definitely still there. You know, the fairs now are, at least most of them, are owned by sort of entertainment corporations. And a lot of people who have been around since the beginning, you know, comment that the fair has, as they say, been cleaned up considerably. There's less sort of off-color humor or less sort of strictly adult spaces than there used to be. But, you know, but all of that is still definitely still there. So, you know, it's sort of like, it's more reliable, I think, as an income. You know, there's a sort of stability that comes from the spread and the sort of operating as a chain. But some people do mourn the early days when it was really just sort of more of a collective project.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things in your book was that you noted that Renaissance fairs now often get mocked. You quote one blogger who calls it redneck Disneyland, and others dismiss it as mortifyingly nerdy. Why is that? Why isn't it as embraced in the mainstream as it might have been before?
Well, you know, first of all, there have always been people, I call them haters in the sort of, you know, the way young people speak. But there's always been a certain amount of that. There was even one year when an organized opposition got the fair shut down and said it attracted too many hippies and weirdies to the area. So this really is a straight development from that. And I think that, you know, the reasons are, as you mentioned, class-based ridicule. Redneck Disneyland sort of sums it up, but there's a lot of that. I think another huge thing I heard about is people who are embarrassed by the idea of men in tights, as they put it, which I think, you know, just has to do with, you know, a fair amount of homophobia and also sort of like rigid ideas about what masculinity should look like. And then the third thing is people who are just horrified that at the fair, large women, you know, sort of dare to show their bodies. So, I mean, and it's also celebrated for that, by the way. I've spoken to many sort of size acceptance advocates who said the fair is the first time I was ever able to feel beautiful as a woman. So, but both, you'll see both sides of that coin. So, yeah. You know, I think the dismissal of the fair, as personal it might feel to people, definitely sort of operates in these ideological ways.
Yeah, and you talk about way back in the 60s. I mean, it wasn't just the regular counterculture. It wasn't just benign hippies. You talk about the socialist and anarchist movements that really took root there, partially related to Pacifica, if I understood correctly. So what is the relation of those movements, which were more extreme, to the Renaissance fair aesthetic?
Well, I think that I guess I don't know exactly what you mean by more extreme, but I would say sort of say that, you know, definitely the Renaissance Fair provided an opportunity for people to have a sort of different kind of economy. And so for some people, you know, this is, as I said before, sort of wanting to have a craft-based economy that sort of privileges the quirky and the handmade. But there are definitely people who wanted to have an economy that was more communal, and, you know, people working at the fair have and still live in communal or semi-communal situations. And for some people, that would articulate itself as socialism. I think for some people would use that word, some people wouldn't use that word, but definitely people were looking for, I think they would agree that they were looking for a kind of alternative economy and finding it here. And we can live by playing music, or we can, you know, live by selling our pottery like that.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the musicians who were inspired by that Renaissance Fair aesthetic, you know, even Bob Dylan, they would have called themselves not singers, but troubadours, storytellers.
That's right. Bob Dylan, who, by the way, you know, did turn up at the fair.
And Tom Brokaw, yeah. Right?
You know, you're absolutely right, though, that use of the word minstrel that, you know, some people did in the sort of in the folk revival
leading
up to the fair and during, right, is a sort of reference to that period. And Dylan used it, too. You know, I don't want to be a spokesperson for my generation. I want to be a minstrel boy.
Yeah. So, Rachel, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Lee Rubin. She wrote a really interesting book called Well Met on the Aesthetics of Renaissance Fairs and the Counterculture. Join us tomorrow. I will still be here, and we are going to talk to Paul Krugman about the Fiscal Cliff and other great spots. Hope to see you there.